This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Multiple militias are in control of the Libyan detention centres, which he kept describing as human warehouses without any central government control, horrendous conditions, no sanitary conditions, he said, no medical care, situations where people were living in very confined spaces with no light, no air conditioning, and very violent guards a lot of the time.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna describing the conditions of migrants held at detention camps in Libya. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, U.S. President Donald Trump met with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi at this hour. Parts of Somalia are in the midst of a growing cholera epidemic, and there's worry over the increasing number of unaccompanied South Sudanese children in refugee camps. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, U.S. President Donald Trump met with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi today. It was the Egyptian leader's first official visit to the White House. President Trump said, "I just want to let everybody know that we are very much behind President el-Sisi. He has done a fantastic job in a very difficult situation." Former President Barack Obama froze aid to Cairo. He took the action after Egypt's military, led by then-General Sisi, overthrew Egypt's first democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi, in 2013. Sisi was elected to the presidency a year later. It's not the first time that Trump and Sisi have met. They are reported to have gotten along well when candidate Trump met the Egyptian leader in September on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. While experts say that President Trump's meeting today with Egyptian President Sisi offers a significant opportunity, but also some risk for U.S. security interests and values. Mohammed El-Shenawy has details.
U.S.-Egyptian ties have witnessed historic strains in the past few years. They occurred at a time when parts of the Middle East were fragmented by uprisings or insurgencies that threatened U.S. interests and the global order. Egyptian President al-Sisi goes to the White House with high expectations for improved bilateral relations after a period which was perceived by many as cool under President Obama. But Michelle Dunn, Middle East Program Director at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, believes that President Trump will realize that there were important reasons behind the strained relations with Egypt. She said both presidents, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, realized over time that the United States-Egyptian partnership was tarnished by Cairo's internal problems, including a lack of social justice and political openness and a poor human rights record.
The question is President Trump going to do the same thing the U.S. has done all along? Whoever is in power, the United States just supports that person in power, even if the relationship is a bit cool. You know, I think it's time to start asking what it is that the United States is getting out of this and whether there could be a more productive partnership.
She said Egypt's new political and economic order remains brittle, lacking a concrete plan for defeating terror networks, advancing large-scale job creation, or offering more effective or representative governance. Instead, the country's civic space is denying openings for the free exchange of ideas needed to defeat extremism. The Egyptian Foreign Ministry denies human rights criticisms. It says individual rights, including freedom of speech, the press, and assembly, are guaranteed by the Egyptian constitution, and it says those rights are protected by both governmental and independent bodies, including the state-appointed National Council for Human Rights and the parliament. And President Sisi has said, given the current security threat, Egypt's human rights record should not be judged by Western standards. He has also said protests harm the country's economy. For many in the United States, Egypt is needed to provide stability in the region and to help counter terrorism. On the other hand, former Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy and Human Rights, Tom Malinowski, said that Egypt receives billions of dollars in U.S. military assistance, but has never helped in the fight against the so-called Islamic State.
Egypt does virtually nothing with us or for us in the fight against ISIL. There are a lot of American-provided F-16s in Egypt that show up at military parades and celebrations. I have not seen any of them show up over the skies of Mosul or Raqqa, where Americans and our coalition partners are actually fighting this common enemy.
Networks of terrorists in the Sinai Peninsula are a security threat not only for Egypt, but also the region, including the Gaza Strip and Israel. Malinowski described the Egyptian handling of terrorism in Sinai as the worst ever. He said mass arrests and human rights abuses alienated more Egyptians. For Bahiyyeddin Hassan, General Director of Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies, the new U.S. administration should expend some of its political capital with Cairo. It can do this, he says, by encouraging tangible progress in opening Egypt's narrowed public sphere and implementing good governance reforms. The United States can also continue to raise publicly and privately issues regarding the rights of Egyptian citizens.
Egyptians are watching with great interest this visit and the Monday meeting and the outcome of this meeting. If the outcome would be unconditional support for Sisi, this would be interpreted by Egyptians as a blessing for long-standing Egyptian suffering under his government.
The latest public opinion survey conducted by the Arab Center in Washington indicated that more than 70% of Egyptians in 2016 have unfavorable views of the United States because it is not supporting their interests. Mohammed Al-Shinawi for VOA News, Washington.
Horrendous conditions, that's how Doctors Without Borders describes the situation of migrants being held in Libyan detention centers. Ariane Henkamp, Director General of Libya Operations for the Medical Aid Group, also known as MSF, held a press conference today in Rome. He says up to 40% of migrants in Libya are forced to get on boats to cross the Mediterranean Sea, adding the risk for women is massive. For example, many Eritrean women take contraception before they leave home, expecting to be raped multiple times. Reporter Josephine McKenna was at the press conference and provides us with details.
A small number of Doctors Without Borders officials and staff are working inside Libya in very difficult conditions, going into detention centres to try and administer medical care where it's needed. Now, he said that multiple militias are in control of the Libyan detention centres, which he kept describing as human warehouses without any central government control, horrendous conditions, no sanitary conditions, he said, no medical care, situations where people were living in very confined spaces with no light, no air conditioning, and very violent guards a lot of the time. And he stressed that these people were really at the complete mercy of their captors.
And I understand the majority of the migrants and refugees are coming from sub-Saharan Africa?
Now, Doctors Without Borders are not given information about the people that they are helping because they are given access to these detention centres by the militias. So he said it's difficult to know where they are coming from, but he said that there were apparently quite a few there from Nigeria, from other parts of sub-Saharan Africa, Eritrea, people making their way through southern Libya. But he also said an interesting thing, that many migrants who have lived in Libya for years, even under Colonel Gaddafi, were being picked up from the streets and forcibly detained and subjected to extortion and abuse and torture in these detention centres themselves. So that's, I think, a new situation, which also indicates how difficult the situation is in Libya for many people who come from migrant backgrounds.
Also, I understand that he referred to the Libya-Italy agreement as dangerous fiction. What does he mean by that?
Well, as we know, Italy and Libya have reached an agreement with the backing of the EU to provide funding and support for the Coast Guard and other security services to try and control the flow of illegal immigration. He said although some Coast Guard members were honest and honourable, he said others were linked to people smugglers, others were fearful of the militias who would perhaps threaten them if they didn't allow the migrants to make that journey across the Mediterranean. Ultimately, he said there's no central government control, only the militias dominating this people smuggling flow. And he said it's la-la land to think that there's any way of controlling this and stopping this from continuing.
There have been some allegations made against NGOs. For example, Frontex has made some allegations. Can you tell us about these?
As we know, Frontex, the European Border Agency, has recently been suggesting that the NGOs are complicit in supporting the people smugglers. And he was asked about that in this press conference he gave in Rome today. Doctors Without Borders say that it's not accidental that there's an increased rhetoric about NGOs in the Mediterranean, particularly when politicians want to stop the flow. They're concerned about elections coming up in France, Germany, and potentially in Italy before early 2018. And Doctors Without Borders are convinced that these allegations and this rhetoric is all about stopping the flow and protecting the political status quo instead of confronting the real issues that are affecting people inside Libya.
What types of solutions were discussed at this meeting, if any?
Well, he said the solution was very difficult. He said it's very easy to identify the problem and the extent of the problem. He spoke about how upset he was seeing how scared and terrified people are living in these detention centres. But to find a solution is the challenge. And he said it's not simply about taking people off the boats and sending them back, because they're often being sent back to worse conditions. He also stressed that it's very difficult to control the tribes in southern Libya who have been involved for many years in the people trafficking situation as well. Even though we saw at the weekend the Italian government said that dozens of rival tribes in southern Libya had agreed to secure the borders, the Doctors Without Borders don't believe that that really is possible.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome. Coming up on 18 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, besides drought, severe malnutrition, and potential famine, parts of Somalia are also in the midst of a cholera epidemic. Reuters reports the head of the EU Humanitarian Aid for Somalia, Johan Heffink, says there have been more than 18,000 cholera cases so far this year. That's 3,000 more than all of last year. An average year for cholera in Somalia is about 5,000 cases. He says the current strain kills around 1 in 45 patients. He calls that unusually deadly. Heffink warns Somalia is close to famine. The current rainy season runs through March to May, but no rain fell last month. Ugandan authorities and relief agencies are worried about the increasing number of unaccompanied South Sudanese children in refugee camps. They say it is hard to reunite the children with their families, and most of them end up in foster care. Many South Sudanese continue to flee their country due to conflict, violence, and famine in some areas. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
15-year-old Nyalok Susan fled from her home in Juba after she was threatened to be killed if she stayed in her home. Susan from Central Equatorial Province says neighbors told her that Noel would tell them to leave their homes. And she says Samuel told them they would not spare anyone, including children and orphans.
We came from school to home. I didn't find my uncle, my auntie. One of my neighbors told me that you not to stay at home. We go somewhere. We went up to Gure. We stayed there for 3 days. Nuer used to get out of South Sudan from Juba. They told us that they don't want to sleep together here again. Anyway, which is empty, you have to go to that country, because when we are going to come back again, we may not select this one is an orphan, this one is the young children.
Susan is not alone. 15-year-old Mabiol Lois narrates how life became difficult after renewed fighting in July forced her to find refuge in Uganda.
My mom is all dead, but my auntie was there in Pakrenya too. I'm here alone. At home I live it because there is no somebody there, and the life is difficult. That's why I come here, to save my life.
According to UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, two-thirds of South Sudanese refugees in Uganda are children under the age of 18 years, and most of these arrive at the refugee transit centers and are accompanied by a parent or adult. Some of the children are placed under the foster care of other refugees to ensure they have an adult to rely on while in the camps. Charlie Ali is the External Relations Officer at UNHCR.
It's clear this is a children's emergency. It's children that are being forced to flee their homes, often because of attacks in the middle of the night, that are being forced to walk through the bush for days, if not weeks, without access to food or water. And it's children that are being deprived of their right to a normal life. The UNHCR are here working with the government and our partners to help those children that have been separated from their parents to be reunited with those parents if they're already here somewhere in Uganda or in the region. And in the meantime, they're being provided with foster care as well as critical life-saving assistance such as food, water and a roof over their heads.
Catherine Nakazi, a Uganda Red Cross Society official, says tracing the families of the children is challenging, but they are working with other agencies to ensure the children are united with their families.
Some of them don't have any telephone contact, so that process takes time, but we have to make sure we go through that process until we get their family people and unite them. In partnership with the Red Cross Family Tracing Unit in Sudan, we get to know their family members.
Uganda is currently home to over 800,000 South Sudan refugees. A majority of them fled renewed fighting in July between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar. 886 new arrivals have been recorded daily between 15th and 28th March, and 64% of these are children, some as young as 4 years old. About 400 unaccompanied minors have been reported in the various South Sudan refugee camps in Uganda, a number said to be overwhelming as far as provision of basic services as well as finding parents, guardians and foster homes is concerned. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
African diplomats have told the Indian government to do more to protect African citizens from racist attacks. AFP reports representatives from 44 African countries criticized Indian officials following a series of brutal assaults targeting Nigerians. The last attack occurred 1 week ago when a mob went on a rampage near New Delhi. They took to the streets because of rumors that blamed Nigerians in the death of a teenage boy. A group of Nigerian students was detained after the incident and then released due to a lack of evidence. The incident was recorded and then shared on social media. African diplomats also have called for an independent investigation of the violence, which they call xenophobic and racial. Cameroon's government says secessionist groups in the English-speaking regions are behind arson attacks on public buildings. The most recent attack was on a large market in the town of Limbe. The fires are prompting renewed calls for dialogue to end the 5-month strike in the English-speaking areas. Moki Edwin Kinziga reports from Limbe, Cameroon.
The fire at Limbe Market burned for 4 hours Saturday. 50 shops were destroyed. The governor of the Southwest Region, Bernard Okalia Bilai, said police arrested a suspect believed to belong to a secessionist group.
The suspect has already denounced many of his accomplices. And those who are in a way or another linked to this act of terrorism will be answered. We want to call the population of the Southwest back to peace. And I want to reassure the population of Limbe, the administration is there with the forces of law to protect them.
The fire at Limbe Market points to the dangers and the cost of the deepening impasse in Cameroon's two English-speaking zones. Lawyers and teachers in those areas, the Northwest and the Southwest, have been on strike since November. Most schools in the affected zones remain closed and business is paralyzed. The strikers are demanding reforms to counter what they say is the overwhelming use of French in the bilingual country. But while some strikers are demanding a return to federalism, other activists are calling for total independence for the English-speaking zones, ratcheting up tensions and violence. Several schools, private residences, police stations, administrative buildings have been burned. No one has claimed responsibility. Lawmaker Eno Tanjong from the Southwest region addressed his fellow senators on March 13.
I would like to point out and castigate the arson that ravaged the Faculty of Medicine of the University in Bamenda and the destruction of the administrative block of the government high school, Akwaya. The political elite, religious figures, members of the civil society, traditional rulers have all joined the head of state in appealing for dialogue and peace.
Visiting Bamenda in the northwest 2 weeks ago, Cameroon's prime minister called the destruction an attempt to exert pressure on the government. In response, the government has cut internet to affected zones and made arrests. That includes three community leaders charged in relation to the violent unrest in December. If convicted, they could face the death penalty, according to Cameroon's 2014 anti-terrorism law. Negotiations to end the strike fell apart when the state refused the strikers' demand to release everyone currently detained. Lawmaker Joseph Banadzam of the opposition Social Democratic Front is calling for compromise.
Government and the strikers should come back to the negotiating table. And I think one of the conditions which they are requesting is the release of those who are negotiating with government who have been caught and brought to Yaoundé. Peace has no price. We should be able to have some amnesty, release these people, and let school start.
President Paul Biya has on several public outings declared that he is open for dialogue, but that he is not ready to release arrested suspects and that he is not open for any discussions that call into question national unity. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Limbe, Cameroon.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Take your peek, watch on television, log on to the internet, listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss Against All Odds, a book written by Cameroonian lawyer Angela Kwemo. It's a practical guide to making the most of your God-given talents and using them to better yourself, your country, Africa, and the human race. That's all on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.